You were just saying about you weren't able quite to function as you would have done.
Yes, it would have been easier for me had that particular person come up some years earlier, because it's expected of a station commander that he lives on the station, and that his wife generally is with him, and that although it's an unpaid role, his wife usually is involved with the wives on the station and can, if she's an active wife, can set up and various things of help to assist in morale factors like running parties or whatever it may be, and putting on social functions for the officers' wives on the station. That, unfortunately, I didn't experience because it was the wrong time. In fact, I had to prepare really to be leaving the service and what would happen after that, and so I didn't feel as happy as I should have been in that sense, because I knew there were one or two things that were not for, although I mean everybody in those days up there lived off the station, so there was nothing unusual about officers living off the station. Majority were doing it in the 70s when that came about. In fact, I came down each night as the other officers and my own officers were leaving the station. So I suppose it wasn't quite as critical as it might have been in previous decades. But that was one of the difficulties there. Although that didn't stop me from attending or being invited to the AOC's socials and things like that, which was good. So that did seem to me that I'd probably... at the end of my tour, hadn't done too badly. And then, very interestingly enough and surprisingly enough, I had a phone call from the Ministry of Defence saying that they had chosen me and selected me for to serve a further 3 years over and above the compulsory retirement age of 55. 57, and would I accept a further 3 years of active service? But I evaluated what they were saying, and I thought, no, I think I've done enough. And strangely, on reflection, I never asked them, which I could have done, and they must have known. They must have had a posting lined up for me somewhere that they wanted me particularly to go to. I never asked them that question. I asked them a lot of other questions, things like pensions and gratuities and more mundane matters. But I should have really asked them, you've obviously got something lined up for me, can you tell me where you're thinking of sending me? And that might have made a difference. I'm not sure. But anyway, I didn't ask that question, and I rejected the offer.
Given the amount of time that you'd spent in the RAF, were you given any kind of help for returning to retirement or returning to civilian life? Did they help you in that way?
Yes. There were a variety of openings that you could go to for various periods. If you wanted to learn how to lay a brick, you could go on a bricklayer's course. If you wanted to become an actor, you could go to a theatre and become part of the staff for 6 weeks. I chose to stay within the acting theatre. In fact, although I hadn't mentioned, I had decided when I was at Cosford that I would retire early and take up professional acting. Fortunately, they rejected my application to go, which was just as well. And so I didn't leave. So anyway, when it came to retirement, I went down to the Old Vic Theatre in Bristol and had a chat with the management there and said what I had in mind, and I said perhaps I could stay here for 6 weeks and watch what goes on in the theatre and in the professional side. And they said yes, you can come, So I went down to Bristol after I retired and spent 6 weeks down there making up my mind of what I was going to do. But at the end of it, I realised that I'd made a wrong decision, and that was the end of that. I carried on acting a great deal, but I didn't become professional. And I've been on stage with a lot of professionals over the years, and I realised it was too late, much too late. When you're an actor and you're learning your trade, you go to various places, don't you? And you, in various types of boarding houses where you have to be put up for a week, washed up, showing it. And I thought, no, I don't think so. I think it's a bit late for this sort of thing. I'm supposed to retire to a pleasant lifestyle. And I thought, being in some boarding house up in some strange town somewhere and staying there, and I thought, no, I don't think so.
Just really, then, one last question. How do you feel now about having served the RAF for that period of time?
Oh, I think I made the right decision. There were bad spots from time to time, but I haven't got the slightest regret at what I did in the RAF, and I haven't got anything that I'm ashamed of. There's nothing that I have that I'm ashamed of. That I was associated with. I think it was. I made the right decision. I didn't mention. The burden that one had to carry through the service, in my case, and a lot of other officers, was this. I wasn't granted a standard permanent commission. I was, because of my age and things, when I applied, I was granted a permanent commission, but tagged supplementary. Now, I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but it was a pernicious way of retaining officers in the service, but limiting them in terms of paying and careers. By doing so, it meant that they kept all the experienced people in on limited promotion and career prospects and limited pay prospects and all that sort of thing. Now, I accepted one of those things. Some of my friends later on in the service felt that it wasn't fair, and they just opted out. Well, there were various changes that took place in the RAF, particularly around about the 60s, when they extended the retirement ages and restructured officers' periods of service. And they came out there was a new retirement age now. If you were selected, you could retire at 57, as opposed to 49, and in duty cases 42. And so I saw these restructured things, and I thought, well, that seems reasonable. Things must change in that length of time. Well, it didn't. The chains that one pulled around as a supplementary list officer meant that there was nothing you could do to enhance promotion prospects. You couldn't even. I actually went on the junior command and staff course and completed that, which was not a door that was normally open for supplementary list officers, because they weren't going to be in the position of being promoted. So therefore, why bother to send them to a staff school? But I did manage to do that because I was doing staff appointments at these various jobs. And it was right, they decided it was right that I should be sent on the staff course to do it. And that was right. But it did mean that as the years went by, it meant that never mind what sort of job you were doing, how well you did it, whatever happened, promotion never came. It was no good your senior officer putting you down, recommended for accelerated promotion, because there was no way. And so to be promoted as a supplementalist officer became something special. There would probably only be maybe one or two junior officers promoted to senior rank if they were supplementalist officer per year, to a half year in the promotion list. So you might find four people in a year of being promoted. Yeah, and that meant you'd be lucky, and many people didn't get promoted. It was only a minority got promoted, and I think that was basically inhuman, because it meant that officers with enthusiasm and so on were denied both promotion and the type of posts. Because you were limited on promotion, they could send you down to these things. Instead, if you were promoted, you wouldn't be doing that job. But because the system wouldn't allow you to be promoted, they could put you in any job. And that was, I think, and the other officers said the same, it was a big failure. And it took me to be a staff officer again at Air Squadron to get a commander from the CNC before I could get promotions. And that, I think, was a restrictive constant chain on what you did, in the knowledge of what you did, how hard you worked. There was nothing for it. In fact, it was even more embarrassing functioning than that, because having reached the maximum seniority for, say, a flight lieutenant, there was no more pay increases. So you would go on forever, never ever getting a single incremental supplement. But they recognized that was unfair, and so some years later, when the gap, now you've got officers who've been in the service longer than a lot of people, have never had a pay rise. So they then decided, as you may know, to extend the period in which you could get incremental things. So whereas it ceased at 12, they moved it up to 16 or 18 years in the rank. And now, that was just a reflection, a side effect of this false doctrine. I don't think that there was anything wrong in opening. If you wanted those people, they should have either decided they were going to categorize them, give them special pay to compensate them, but no, they never did. Now, on the aircrew side, the practice in flying aircrew, the senior flying crew, the flight lieutenants, who were on supplementary list commissions, the same as I was, they found that couldn't stand up to the weather of the outside economies with their lucrative captains and aircrew pay. So what did they do? The proper solution to that was to upgrade them in rank. So all those people in that category with the appropriate senior all promoted to squadron leader. So their salaries, of course, went up, and their increment salary went up. So that's how they corrected it there. But they never did that in other branches.